This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind by Scott Stossel. Read for you by Michael Goldstrom. Part 1. The Riddle of Anxiety. Chapter 1. The Nature of Anxiety. And no grand inquisitor has in readiness such terrible tortures as has anxiety. And no spy knows how to attack more artfully the man he suspects, choosing the instant when he is weakest, nor knows how to lay traps where he will be caught and ensnared, as anxiety knows how. And no sharp-witted judge knows how to interrogate, to examine the accused as anxiety does, which never lets him escape. Neither by diversion nor by noise, neither at work nor at play, neither by day nor by night. Soren Kierkegaard, The Concept of Anxiety, 1844. There is no question that the problem of anxiety is a nodal point at which the most various and important questions converge, a riddle whose solution would be bound to throw a flood of light on our whole mental existence. Sigmund Freud, Introductory Lectures on Psychoanalysis, 1933. I have an unfortunate tendency to falter at crucial moments. For instance, standing at the altar in a church in Vermont, waiting for my wife-to-be to come down the aisle to marry me, I start to feel horribly ill. Not just vaguely queasy, but severely nauseated and shaky, and, most of all, sweaty. The church is hot that day, it's early July, and many people are perspiring in their summer suits and sundresses, but not like I am. As the processional plays, sweat begins to bead on my forehead and above my upper lip. In wedding photos, you can see me standing tensely at the altar, a grim half-smile on my face, as I watch my fiancé come down the aisle on the arm of her father. In the photos, Susanna is glowing. I am glistening. By the time she joins me in the front of the church, rivulets of sweat are running into my eyes and dripping down my collar. We turn to face the minister. Behind him are the friends we have asked to give readings, and I see them looking at me with manifest concern. What's wrong with him? I imagine they are thinking. Is he going to pass out? Merely imagining these thoughts makes me sweat even more. My best man, standing a few feet behind me, taps me on the shoulder and hands me a tissue to mop my brow. My friend Kathy, sitting many rows back in the church, will tell me later that she had a strong urge to bring me a glass of water. It looked, she said, as if I had just run a marathon. The wedding reader's facial expressions have gone from registering mild concern to what appears to me to be unconcealed horror. Is he going to die? I'm beginning to wonder that myself, for I have started to shake. I don't mean slight trembling, the sort of subtle tremor that would be evident only if I were holding a piece of paper. I feel like I'm on the verge of convulsing. I'm concentrating on keeping my legs from flying out from under me like an epileptic's, and I'm hoping that my pants are baggy enough to keep the trembling from being too visible. I'm now leaning on my almost wife. There is no hiding the trembling from her, and she is doing her best to hold me up. The minister is droning on. I have no idea what he's saying. I am not, as they say, present in the moment. I'm praying for him to hurry up so I can escape this torment. He pauses and looks down at my betrothed and me. Seeing me, the sheen of flop sweat, the panic in my eyes, he is alarmed. Are you okay? He mouths silently. Helplessly, I nod that I am. Because what would he do if I said that I wasn't? Clear the church? The mortification would be unbearable. As the minister resumes his sermon, here are three things I am actively fighting. The shaking of my limbs, the urge to vomit, and unconsciousness. And this is what I am thinking. Get me out of here. Why? because there are nearly 300 people, friends and family and colleagues, watching us get married, and I am about to collapse. I have lost control of my body. This is supposed to be one of the happiest, most significant moments of my life, and I am miserable. I worry I will not survive. As I sweat and swoon and shake, struggling to carry out the wedding ritual, saying I do, putting the rings on, kissing the bride, I am worrying wretchedly about what everyone, my wife's parents, her friends, my colleagues, must be thinking as they look at me. Is he having second thoughts about getting married? Is this evidence of his essential weakness, his cowardice, his spousal unsuitability? Any doubt that any friend of my wife's had, I fear, is being confirmed. I knew it. I imagine those friends thinking, this proves he's not worthy of marrying her. I look as though I've taken a shower with my clothes on. My sweat glands, my physical frailty, my weak moral fiber have been revealed to the world. The unworthiness of my very existence has been exposed. Mercifully, the ceremony ends. Drenched in sweat, I walk down the aisle, clinging gratefully to my new wife. And when we get outside the church, the acute physical symptoms recede. I'm not going to have convulsions. I'm not going to pass out. But as I stand in the reception line and then drink and dance at the reception, I'm pantomiming happiness. I'm smiling for the camera, shaking hands, and wanting to die. And why not? I have failed at one of the most elemental of male jobs, getting married. How have I managed to cock this up too? For the next 72 hours, I endure a brutal, self-lacerating despair. Anxiety kills relatively few people, but many more would welcome death as an alternative to the paralysis and suffering resulting from anxiety in its severe forms. David H. Barlow, Anxiety and Its Disorders, 2004. My wedding was not the first time I'd broken down, nor was it the last. At the birth of our first child, the nurses had to briefly stop ministering to my wife, who was in the throes of labor, to attend to me as I turned pale and keeled over. I've frozen, mortifyingly, on stage at public lectures and presentations, and on several occasions I have been compelled to run off stage. I've abandoned dates, walked out of exams, and had breakdowns during job interviews, on plane flights, train trips and car rides, and simply walking down the street. On ordinary days, doing ordinary things, reading a book, lying in bed, talking on the phone, sitting in a meeting, playing tennis, I have thousands of times been stricken by a pervasive sense of existential dread and been beset by nausea, vertigo, shaking, and a panoply of other physical symptoms. In these instances, I have sometimes been convinced that death, or something somehow worse, was imminent. Even when not actively afflicted by such acute episodes, I am buffeted by worry about my health and my family members' health, about finances, about work, about the rattle in my car and the dripping in my basement, about the encroachment of old age and the inevitability of death, about everything and nothing. Sometimes this worry gets transmuted into low-grade physical discomfort. Stomach aches, headaches, dizziness, pains in my arms and legs, or a general malaise, as though I have mononucleosis or the flu. At various times I have developed anxiety-induced difficulties breathing, swallowing, even walking. These difficulties then become obsessions, consuming all of my thinking. I also suffer from a number of specific fears or phobias. To name a few, enclosed spaces, claustrophobia, heights, acrophobia, fainting, asthenophobia, being trapped far from home, a species of agoraphobia, germs, bacillophobia, cheese, no term for that one, speaking in public, a subcategory of social phobia, flying, aerophobia, vomiting, emetophobia, and naturally, vomiting on airplanes, aeronausophobia. When I was a child and my mother was attending law school at night, I spent evenings at home with a babysitter, abjectly terrified that my parents had died in a car crash or had abandoned me. The clinical term for this is separation anxiety. By age 7, I had worn grooves in the carpet of my bedroom with my relentless pacing, trying to will my parents to come home. During first grade, I spent nearly every afternoon for months in the school nurse's office, sick with psychosomatic headaches, begging to go home. By third grade, stomach aches had replaced headaches, but my daily trudge to the infirmary remained the same. During high school, I would purposely lose tennis and squash matches to escape the agony of anxiety that competitive situations would provoke in me. On the one, the only one, date I had in high school, when the young lady leaned in for a kiss during a romantic moment, we were outside, gazing at constellations through her telescope, I was overcome by anxiety and had to pull away for fear that I would vomit. My embarrassment was such that I stopped returning her phone calls. In short, I have since the age of about 2 been a twitchy bundle of phobias, fears, and neuroses. And I have, since the age of 10, when I was first taken to a mental hospital for evaluation and then referred to a psychiatrist for treatment, tried in various ways to overcome my anxiety. Here's what I've tried. Individual psychotherapy, 3 decades of it. Family therapy, group therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, rational emotive therapy, RET, acceptance and commitment therapy, ACT, hypnosis, meditation, role-playing, interoceptive exposure therapy, in vivo exposure therapy, supportive expressive therapy, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, EMDR, self-help workbooks, massage therapy, prayer, acupuncture, yoga, stoic philosophy, and audio tapes I ordered off a late-night TV infomercial. And medication. Lots of medication. Thorazine, imipramine, disipramine, chlorpheniramine, Nardil, Buspar, Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, Wellbutrin, Effexor, Celexa, Lexapro, Cymbalta, Luvox, Trazodone, Levoxil, Propranolol, Transine, Cerax, Centrax, St. John's Wort, Zolpidem, Valium, Librium, Ativan, Xanax, Clonopin. Also, beer, wine, gin, bourbon, vodka, and scotch. Here's what's worked. Nothing. Actually, that's not entirely true. Some drugs have helped a little, for finite periods of time. Thorazine, an antipsychotic which used to be classified as a major sedative, and imipramine, a tricyclic antidepressant, combined to help keep me out of the psychiatric hospital in the early 1980s when I was in middle school and ravaged by anxiety. Disipramine, another tricyclic, got me through my early 20s. Paxil, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, or SSRI, gave me about 6 months of significantly reduced anxiety in my late 20s before the fear broke through again. Ample quantities of Xanax, propranolol, and vodka got me, barely, through a book tour and various public lectures and TV appearances in my early 30s. A double scotch plus a Xanax and a Dramamine can sometimes, when administered before takeoff, make flying tolerable. And 2 double scotches, when administered in quick enough succession, can obscure existential dread, making it seem fuzzier and further away. But none of these treatments have fundamentally reduced the underlying anxiety that seems woven into my soul and hardwired into my body, and that at times makes my life a misery. As the years pass, the hope of being cured of my anxiety has faded into a resigned desire to come to terms with it, to find some redemptive quality or mitigating benefit to my being, too often a quivering, quaking, neurotic wreck. Anxiety is the most prominent mental characteristic of Occidental civilization. R.R. Willoughby, Magic and Cognate Phenomena, 1935. Anxiety and its associated disorders represent the most common form of officially classified mental illness in the United States today, more common even than depression and other mood disorders. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, some 40 million Americans, nearly one in seven of us, are suffering from some kind of anxiety disorder at any given time, accounting for 31% of the expenditures on mental health care in the United States. According to recent epidemiological data, the lifetime incidence of anxiety disorder is more than 25%, which, if true, means that one in four of us can expect to be stricken by debilitating anxiety at some point in our lifetimes. And it is debilitating. Recent academic papers have argued that the psychic and physical impairment tied to living with an anxiety disorder is equivalent to living with diabetes, usually manageable, sometimes fatal, and always a pain to deal with. A study published in the American Journal of Psychiatry in 2006 found that Americans lose a collective 321 million days of work because of anxiety and depression each year, costing the economy $50 billion annually. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics once estimated that the median number of days missed each year by an American worker because of anxiety or stress is 25. In 2005, 3 years before the recent economic crisis hit, Americans filled 53 million prescriptions for just two anti-anxiety drugs, Ativan and Xanax. In the weeks after 9/11, Xanax prescriptions jumped 9% nationally and by 22% in New York City. In September 2008, the economic crash caused prescriptions in New York City to spike. As banks went belly up and the stock market went into freefall, prescriptions for antidepressant and anti-anxiety medications increased 9% over the year before, while prescriptions for sleeping pills increased 11%. Though some have argued that anxiety is a particularly American affliction, it's not just Americans who suffer from it. A report published in 2009 by the Mental Health Foundation in England found that 15% of people living in the United Kingdom are currently suffering from an anxiety disorder and that rates are increasing. 37% of British people report feeling more frightened than they used to. A recent paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association observed that anxiety disorders are the most common mental condition in many countries. A comprehensive global review of anxiety studies published in 2006 in the Canadian Journal of Psychiatry concluded that as many as one in six people worldwide will be afflicted with an anxiety disorder for at least a year during some point in their lifetimes. Other studies have reported similar findings. Of course, these figures refer only to people like me, who are, according to the somewhat arbitrary diagnostic criteria established by the American Psychiatric Association, technically classifiable as clinically anxious. But anxiety extends far beyond the population of the officially mentally ill. Primary care physicians report that anxiety is one of the most frequent complaints driving patients to their offices, more frequent by some accounts than the common cold. One large-scale study from 1985 found that anxiety prompted more than 11% of all visits to family doctors. A study the following year reported that as many as one in three patients complained to their family physicians of severe anxiety. Other studies have reported that 20% of primary care patients in America are taking a benzodiazepine, such as Valium or Xanax. And almost everyone alive has at some point experienced the torments of anxiety, or of fear, or of stress, or of worry, which are distinct but related phenomena. Those who are unable to experience anxiety are, generally speaking, more deeply pathological and more dangerous to society than those who experience it acutely or irrationally. They're sociopaths. Few people today would dispute that chronic stress is a hallmark of our times, or that anxiety has become a kind of cultural condition of modernity. We live, as has been said many times since the dawn of the atomic era, in an age of anxiety, and that, cliché though it may be, seems only to have become more true in recent years as America has been assaulted in short order by terrorism, economic calamity and disruption, and widespread social transformation. And yet, as recently as 30 years ago, anxiety per se did not exist as a clinical category. In 1950, when the psychoanalyst Rollo May published The Meaning of Anxiety, he observed that at that point, only two others, Soren Kierkegaard and Sigmund Freud, had undertaken book-length treatments of the idea of anxiety. In 1927, according to the listing in Psychological Abstracts, only three academic papers on anxiety were published. In 1941, there were only 14. And as late as 1950, there were only 37. The first ever academic conference dedicated solely to the topic of anxiety didn't take place until June 1949. Only in 1980, after new drugs designed to treat anxiety had been developed and brought to market, were the anxiety disorders finally introduced into the third edition of the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, displacing the Freudian neuroses. In an important sense, the treatment predated the diagnosis. That is, the discovery of anti-anxiety drugs drove the creation of anxiety as a diagnostic category. Today, thousands of papers about anxiety are published each year. Several academic journals are wholly dedicated to it. Anxiety research is constantly yielding new discoveries and insights, not only about the causes of and treatments for anxiety, but also, more generally, about how the mind works, about the relationships between mind and body, between genes and behavior, and between molecules and emotion. Using functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI technology, we can now map various subjectively experienced emotions onto specific parts of the brain, and can even distinguish various types of anxiety based on their visible effect on brain function. For instance, generalized worry about future events, my concern about whether the publishing industry will survive long enough for this book to come out, say, or about whether my kids will be able to afford to go to college, tends to appear as hyperactivity in the frontal lobes of the cerebral cortex. The severe anxiety that some people experience while speaking in public, like the sheer terror dulled by drugs and alcohol that I experienced while giving a lecture the other day, or that some extremely shy people experience in socializing, tends to show up as excessive activity in what's called the anterior cingulate. Obsessive-compulsive anxiety, meanwhile, can manifest itself on a brain scan as a disturbance in the circuit linking the frontal lobes with the lower brain centers within the basal ganglia. We now know, thanks to pioneering research by the neuroscientist Joseph Ledoux in the 1980s, that most fearful emotions and behaviors are in one way or another produced by, or at least processed through, the amygdala, a tiny almond-shaped organ at the base of the brain that has become the target of much of the neuroscientific research on anxiety over the last 15 years. We also know far more than Freud or Kierkegaard did about how different neurotransmitters, such as serotonin, dopamine, gamma-aminobutyric acid, norepinephrine, and neuropeptide Y reduce or increase anxiety. And we know there is a strong genetic component to anxiety. We are even starting to learn in some detail what that component consists of. In 2002, to cite just one example among many hundreds, researchers at Harvard University identified what the media called the Woody Allen gene, because it activates a specific group of neurons in the amygdala and elsewhere in the crucial parts of the neural circuit governing fearful behavior. Today, researchers are homing in on numerous such candidate genes, measuring the statistical association between certain genetic variations and certain anxiety disorders, and exploring the chemical and neuroanatomical mechanisms that mediate this association, trying to discover precisely what it is that converts a genetic predisposition into an actual anxious emotion or disorder. The real excitement here both in the study of anxiety as an emotion and in the class of disorders, says Dr. Thomas Insull, the head of the National Institute of Mental Health, is that it's one of the places where we can begin to make the transition between understanding the molecules, the cells, and the system right to the emotion and behavior. We are now finally able to draw the lines between the genes, the cells, and the brain and brain systems. Fear arises from a weakness of mind and therefore does not appertain to the use of reason. Baruch Spinoza, circa 1670. And yet, for all the advances brought by the study of neurochemistry and neuroanatomy, my own experience suggests that the psychological field remains riven by disputes over what causes anxiety and how to treat it. The psychopharmacologists and psychiatrists I've consulted tell me that drugs are a treatment for my anxiety. The cognitive behavioral therapists I've consulted sometimes tell me that drugs are partly a cause of it. The clash between cognitive behavioral therapy and psychopharmacology is merely the latest iteration of a debate that is several millennia old. Molecular biology, biochemistry, regression analysis, and functional magnetic resonance imaging, all of these developments have made possible discoveries and scientific rigor, as well as courses of treatment that Freud and his intellectual forebears could scarcely have dreamed of. Yet while what Thomas Insull of the NIMH says about anxiety research being at the cutting edge of scientific inquiry into human psychology is true, it is also true that in an important sense, there is nothing new under the sun. The cognitive behavioral therapist's antecedents can be traced to the 17th century Jewish Dutch philosopher Baruch Spinoza, who believed anxiety was a mere problem of logic. Faulty thinking causes us to fear things we cannot control, Spinoza argued, presaging by more than 300 years the cognitive behavioral therapist's arguments about faulty cognitions. If we can't control something, there's no value in fearing it, since the fear accomplishes nothing. Spinoza's philosophy seemed to have worked for him. Biographies report him to have been a notably serene individual. Some 1,600 years before Spinoza, the Stoic philosopher Epictetus anticipated the same idea about faulty cognitions. People are not disturbed by things, but by the view they take of them, he wrote in the first century. For Epictetus, the roots of anxiety lay not in our biology, but in how we apprehend reality. Alleviating anxiety is a matter of correcting erroneous perceptions, as the cognitive behavioral therapists say. The Stoics, in fact, may be the true progenitors of cognitive behavioral therapy. When Seneca, a contemporary of Epictetus, wrote, "There are more things to alarm us than to harm us, and we suffer more in apprehension than in reality," he was prefiguring by 20 centuries what Aaron Beck, the official founder of CBT, would say in the 1950s. Seneca was also in some sense anticipating FDR's famous formulation, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." The intellectual antecedents of modern psychopharmacology lie even further in the past. Hippocrates, the ancient Greek doctor, concluded in the 4th century BC that pathological anxiety was a straightforward biological and medical problem. "If you cut open the head of a mentally ill individual," Hippocrates wrote, "you will find the brain humid, full of sweat and smelling badly." For Hippocrates, body juices were the cause of madness. A sudden flood of bile to the brain would produce anxiety. Following Hippocrates, Aristotle placed great weight on the temperature of bile. Warm bile generated warmth and enthusiasm. Cold bile produced anxiety and cowardice. In Hippocrates' view, anxiety and other psychiatric disorders were a medical biological problem best treated by getting the humors back into proper equilibrium. Hippocrates believed that staying in good physical and mental health required maintaining the right balance of what he called the four humors, or bodily fluids, blood, phlegm, black bile, and yellow bile. A person's relative humoral balance accounted for his temperament. Whereas someone with relatively more blood might have a fiery complexion and a lively or sanguine temperament and be given to hot-blooded explosions of temper, someone with relatively more black bile might have swarthy skin and a melancholic temperament. An optimal mixture of the humors, eucrasia, produced a state of health. When the humors fell into disequilibrium, dyscrasia, the result was disease. Though Hippocrates's humoral theory of mind is now discredited, it persisted for 2,000 years, until the 1700s, and it lives on still in our use of words like bilious and phlegmatic to describe people's personalities and in the biomedical approach to anxiety and mental illness generally. But Plato and his adherents, for their part, believed that psychic life was autonomous from physiology and disagreed with the idea that anxiety or melancholy had an organic basis in the body. The biological model of mental illness was, as one ancient Greek philosopher put it, as vain as a child's story. In Plato's view, while physicians could sometimes provide relief for minor psychological ailments, because sometimes emotional problems are refracted into the body, deep-seated emotional problems could be addressed only by philosophers. Anxiety and other mental discomfort arose not from physiological imbalances, but from disharmony of the soul. Recovery demanded deeper self-knowledge, more self-control, and a way of life guided by philosophy. Plato believed that, as one historian of science has put it, if one's body and mind are in generally good shape, a doctor can come along and put minor ills to right, just as one might call in a plumber. But if the general fabric is impaired, a physician is useless. Philosophy, in this view, was the only proper method for treating the soul. Poppycock, said Hippocrates, all that philosophers have written on natural science no more pertains to medicine than to painting, he declared. Or someone who followed him declared, most historians believe that what have come down to us as the so-called Hippocratic writings were in fact produced by a number of doctors who were followers of Hippocrates. Some of the writings in the corpus seem to date from after his death and are believed to have been written by his son-in-law, Polybus. Hippocrates's sons, Draco and Thessalus, also became famous doctors. For simplicity's sake, I treat Hippocrates's writing as the work of one man, since the mode of thinking that the writings represent derives from him. Is pathological anxiety a medical illness, as Hippocrates and Aristotle and modern pharmacologists would have it? Or is it a philosophical problem, as Plato and Spinoza and the cognitive behavioral therapists would have it? Is it a psychological problem, a product of childhood trauma and sexual inhibition, as Freud and his acolytes would have it? Or is it a spiritual condition, as Soren Kierkegaard and his existentialist descendants claimed? Or finally, is it, as W. H. Auden and David Reisman and Erich Fromm and Albert Camus and scores of modern commentators have declared, a cultural condition, a function of the times we live in and the structure of our society? The truth is that anxiety is at once a function of biology and philosophy, body and mind, instinct and reason, personality and culture. Even as anxiety is experienced at a spiritual and psychological level, it is scientifically measurable at the molecular level and the physiological level. It is produced by nature, and it is produced by nurture. It's a psychological phenomenon and a sociological phenomenon. In computer terms, it's both a hardware problem, I'm wired badly, and a software problem. I run faulty logic programs that make me think anxious thoughts. The origins of a temperament are many-faceted. Emotional dispositions that may seem to have a simple single source, a bad gene, say, or a childhood trauma, may not. After all, who's to say that Spinoza's vaunted equanimity didn't derive less from his philosophy than from his biology? Mightn't a genetically programmed low level of autonomic arousal have produced his serene philosophy, rather than the other way around. Neuroses are generated not only by incidental individual experiences, but also by the specific cultural conditions under which we live. It is an individual fate, for example, to have a domineering or a self-sacrificing mother. But it is only under definite cultural conditions that we find domineering or self-sacrificing mothers. Karen Horney, The Neurotic Personality of Our Time, 1937. I don't have to look far to find evidence of anxiety as a family trait. My great-grandfather, Chester Hanford, for many years the dean of students at Harvard, was in the late 1940s admitted to McLean Hospital, the famous mental institution in Belmont, Massachusetts, suffering from acute anxiety. The last 30 years of his life were often agony. Though medication and electroshock treatments would occasionally bring about remissions in his suffering, such respites were temporary, and in his darkest moments in the 1960s, he was reduced to a fetal ball in his bedroom, producing what my parents recall as an inhuman-sounding moaning. Weighed down by the responsibility of caring for him, his wife, my great-grandmother, a formidable and brilliant woman, died from an overdose of scotch and sleeping pills in 1969. Chester Hanford's son is my maternal grandfather. Now 93 years old, he is an extremely accomplished and, to outward appearances, confident man. But he has a worry-prone temperament, and for much of his life has been burdened by a collection of rituals typical of obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD, which is officially classified as a species of anxiety disorder. For instance, he will never leave a building other than through the door he came in, a superstition that sometimes leads to complex logistical maneuverings. My mother, in turn, is a high-strung and inveterate worrier and suffers from many of the same phobias and neuroses that I do. She assiduously avoids heights, glass elevators, chairlifts, public speaking, and risk-taking of most kinds. Like me, she is also mortally terrified of vomiting. As a young woman, she suffered from frequent and severe panic attacks. At her most anxious, or so my father, her ex-husband, insists, her fears verged on paranoia. While pregnant with me, my father says, she became convinced that a serial killer in a yellow Volkswagen was watching our apartment. Today, my mother and father, now divorced 15 years, disagree about the severity of the paranoia. My father insists it was considerable, my mother says it was minor, and that, for that matter, there was actually a serial killer afoot at the time. My only sibling, a younger sister, struggles with anxiety that is different from mine, but nonetheless intense. She, too, has taken Celexa, and also Prozac, and Wellbutrin, and Nardil, and Neurontin, and Buspar. None of them worked for her, and today she may be one of the few adult members of my mother's side of the family not currently taking a psychiatric medication. Various other relatives on my mother's side have also relied on antidepressants and anti-anxiety medications continuously for many years. On the evidence of just these four generations on my mother's side, and there is a separate complement of psychopathology coming down to me on the side of my father, who drank himself into unconsciousness 5 nights out of every 7 throughout much of my later childhood, it is not outlandish to conclude that I possess a genetic predisposition to anxiety and depression. But these facts by themselves are not dispositive, because is it not possible that the bequeathing of anxiety from one generation to the next on my mother's side had nothing to do with genes and everything to do with the environment? In the 1920s, my great-grandparents had a young child who died of an infection. This was devastating to them. Perhaps this trauma, combined with the later trauma of having many of his students die in World War II, cracked something in my great-grandfather's psyche, and, for that matter, in my grandfather's. My grandfather was in elementary school at the time of his brother's death and can remember sitting alongside the tiny casket as the hearse drove to the cemetery. Perhaps my mother, in turn, acquired her own anxieties by witnessing the superstitions and obsessions of her father and the emotional anguish of her grandfather, not to mention the anxious ministrations of her worrywart mother. The psychological term for this is modeling. And perhaps I, observing my mother's phobias, adopted them as my own. While there is substantial evidence that specific phobias, particularly those based on fears that would have been adaptive in the state of nature, like phobias of heights or snakes or rodents, are genetically transmittable or evolutionarily conserved, isn't it just as plausible, if not more so, to conclude that I learned to be fearful by watching my mother be fearful, or that the generally unsettled nature of my childhood psychological environment, my mother's constant anxious buzzing, my father's alcoholic absence, the unhappy tumult of their marriage that would end in divorce, produced in me a comparably unsettled sensibility? Or that my mother's paranoia and panic while pregnant with me produced such hormonal Sturm und Drang in the womb that I was doomed to be born nervous? Research suggests that mothers who suffer stress while pregnant are more likely to produce anxious children. One study found that children whose mothers were pregnant with them on September 11, 2001, still had elevated levels of stress hormones in their blood at 6 months. Similar findings, showing as yet unborn children acquiring higher lifetime baseline levels of stressed-out physiology, have been reported during war and other chaotic times. Thomas Hobbes, the political philosopher, was born prematurely when his mother, terrified by the news that the Spanish Armada was advancing toward English shores, went into labor early in April 1588. "Myself and fear were born twins," Hobbes wrote, and he attributed his own anxious temperament to his mother's terror-induced premature labor. Perhaps Hobbes's view that a powerful state needs to protect citizens from the violence and misery they naturally inflict on one another. "Life," he famously said, "is nasty, brutish, and short," was founded on the anxious temperament imbued in him in utero by his mother's stress hormones. Or do the roots of my anxiety lie deeper and broader than the things I've experienced and the genes I've inherited, that is, in history and in culture? My father's parents were Jews who fled the Nazis in the 1930s. My father's mother became a nastily anti-Semitic Jew. She renounced her Jewishness out of fear that she would someday be persecuted for it. My younger sister and I were raised in the Episcopal Church, our Jewish background hidden from us until I was in college. My father, for his part, has had a lifelong fascination with World War II, and specifically with the Nazis. He watched the television series The World at War again and again. In my memory, that program, with its stentorian music accompanying the Nazi advance on Paris, is the running soundtrack to my early childhood. When my mother was attending law school at night, my sister and I would spend evenings moping around the house while my father played Bach fugues on the piano and then parked himself with a bowl of popcorn and a bottle of gin in front of The World at War. The long-persecuted Jews, of course, have millennia of experience in having reason to be scared, which perhaps explains why some studies have shown that Jewish men suffer from depression and anxiety at rates higher than men in other ethnic groups. There's also evidence that the high IQ scores of Ashkenazi Jews are attached somehow to the high anxiety rates of that same group, and there are plausible evolutionary explanations for why both intelligence and imagination tend to be allied with anxiety. Various studies have found that the average IQ of Ashkenazi Jews is 8 points higher than that of the next highest ethnic group, Northeast Asians, and close to a full standard deviation higher than other European groups. My mother's cultural heritage, on the other hand, was heavily WASP. She is a proud Mayflower descendant, who until recently subscribed wholeheartedly to the notion that there is no emotion and no family issue that should not be suppressed. Thus, me, a mixture of Jewish and WASP pathology, a neurotic and histrionic Jew suppressed inside a neurotic and repressed WASP. No wonder I'm anxious. I'm like Woody Allen, trapped in John Calvin. Or is my anxiety, after all, normal? A natural response to the times we live in? I was in middle school when The Day After, about the dystopian aftermath of a nuclear attack, aired on network television. As an adolescent, I regularly had dreams that ended with a missile streaking across the sky. Were these dreams evidence of anxious psychopathology? Or a reasonable reaction to the conditions I perceived, which were, after all, the same conditions that preoccupied defense policy analysts through the 1980s? The Cold War, of course, has now long since ended, but it has been replaced by the threat of hijacked airplanes, dirty bombs, underwear bombers, chemical attacks, and anthrax, not to mention SARS, swine flu, drug-resistant tuberculosis, the prospect of climate change-induced global apocalypse, and the abiding stresses of a worldwide economic slowdown and of a global economy undergoing seemingly constant upheaval. Insofar as it's possible to measure such things, eras of social transformation seem to produce a quantum increase in the anxiety of the population. In our post-industrial era of economic uncertainty, where social structures are undergoing continuous disruption, and where professional and gender roles are constantly changing, is it not normal, adaptive even, to be anxious? At some level, yes, it is, at least to the extent that it is always, or often, adaptive to be reasonably anxious. According to Charles Darwin, who himself suffered from crippling agoraphobia that left him housebound for years after his voyage on the Beagle, species that fear rightly increase their chances of survival. We anxious people are less likely to remove ourselves from the gene pool by, say, frolicking on the edge of cliffs or becoming fighter pilots. An influential study conducted 100 years ago by two Harvard psychologists, Robert M. Yerkes and John Dillingham Dodson, demonstrated that moderate levels of anxiety improve performance in humans and animals. Too much anxiety, obviously, and performance is impaired. But too little anxiety also impairs performance. When the use of anti-anxiety drugs exploded in the 1950s, some psychiatrists warned about the dangers presented by a society that was not anxious enough. We then faced the prospect of developing a falsely flaccid race of people, which might not be too good for our future, one wrote. Another psychiatrist averred that Van Gogh, Isaac Newton, most of the geniuses and great creators were not tranquil. They were nervous, ego-driven men pushed on by a relentless inner force and beset by anxieties. Is muting such genius a price society would have to pay for drastically reducing anxiety, pharmacologically or otherwise? And would that cost be worthwhile? Without anxiety, little would be accomplished, says David Barlow, the founder and director emeritus of the Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders at Boston University. The performance of athletes, entertainers, executives, artisans, and students would suffer. Creativity would diminish. Crops might not be planted. And we would all achieve that idyllic state long sought after in our fast-paced society of whiling away our lives under a shade tree. This would be as deadly for the species as nuclear war. I have come to believe that anxiety accompanies intellectual activity as its shadow, and that the more we know of the nature of anxiety, the more we will know of intellect. Howard Liddell, The Role of Vigilance in the Development of Animal Neurosis, 1949. Some 80 years ago, Freud proposed that anxiety was a riddle whose solution would be bound to throw a flood of light on our whole mental existence. Unlocking the mysteries of anxiety, he believed, would go far in helping us to unravel the mysteries of the mind, consciousness, the self, identity, intellect, imagination, creativity, not to mention pain, suffering, hope, and regret. To grapple with and understand anxiety is, in some sense, to grapple with and understand the human condition. The differences in how various cultures and eras have perceived and understood anxiety can tell us a lot about those cultures and eras. Why did the ancient Greeks of the Hippocratic school see anxiety mainly as a medical condition, while the Enlightenment philosophers saw it as an intellectual problem? Why did the early existentialists see anxiety as a spiritual condition, while Gilded Age doctors saw it as a specifically Anglo-Saxon stress response, a response that they believed spared Catholic societies to the Industrial Revolution? Why did the early Freudians see anxiety as a psychological condition emanating from sexual inhibition, whereas our own age tends to see it, once again, as a medical and neurochemical condition, a problem of malfunctioning biomechanics? Do these shifting interpretations represent the forward march of progress and science, or simply the changing and often cyclical ways in which cultures work? What does it say about the societies in question that Americans showing up in emergency rooms with panic attacks tend to believe they're having heart attacks, whereas Japanese tend to be afraid they're going to faint? Are the Iranians who complain of what they call heart distress suffering what Western psychiatrists would call panic attacks? Are the ataque de nervios experienced by South Americans simply panic attacks with a Latino inflection? Or are they, as modern researchers now believe, a distinct cultural and medical syndrome? Why do drug treatments for anxiety that work so well on Americans and the French seem not to work effectively on the Chinese? As fascinating and multifarious as these cultural idiosyncrasies are, the underlying consistency of experience across time and cultures speaks to the universality of anxiety as a human trait, even filtered through the distinctive cultural practices and beliefs of the Greenland Inuit 100 years ago. The syndrome the Inuit called kayak angst, those afflicted by it were afraid to go out seal hunting alone, appears to be little different from what we today call agoraphobia. In Hippocrates' ancient writings can be found clinical descriptions of pathological anxiety that sound quite modern. One of his patients was terrified of cats, simple phobia, which today would be coded 300.29 for insurance purposes, according to the classifications of the 5th edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM-5, and another of nightfall. A third, Hippocrates reported, was beset by terror whenever he heard a flute. A fourth could not walk alongside even the shallowest ditch, though he had no problem walking inside the ditch, evidence of what we would today call acrophobia, the fear of heights. Hippocrates also describes a patient suffering what would likely be called, in modern diagnostic terminology, panic disorder with agoraphobia, DSM-5 code 300.22. The condition, as Hippocrates described it, usually attacks abroad if a person is traveling a lonely road somewhere and fear seizes him. The syndromes described by Hippocrates are recognizably the same clinical phenomena described in the latest issues of the Archives of General Psychiatry and Bulletin of the Menninger Clinic. Their similarities bridge the yawning gap of millennia and circumstances that separate them, providing a sense of how, for all the differences in culture and setting, the physiologically anxious aspects of human experience may be universal. In this book, I have set out to explore the riddle of anxiety. I am not a doctor, a psychologist, a sociologist, or a historian of science, any one of whom would bring more scholarly authority to a treatise on anxiety than I do. This is a work of synthesis and reportage, yoking together explorations of the idea of anxiety from history, literature, philosophy, religion, popular culture, and the latest scientific research. All of that woven through something about which I can, alas, claim extensive expertise, my own experience with anxiety. Examining the depths of my own neuroses may seem the height of narcissism, and studies do show that self-preoccupation tends to be tied to anxiety. But it's an exercise with worthy antecedents. In 1621, the Oxford scholar Robert Burton published his canonical The Anatomy of Melancholy, a staggering 1,300-page work of synthesis, whose torrents of scholarly exegesis only partially obscure what it really is, a massive litany of anxious, depressive complaint. In 1733, George Cheney, a prominent London physician and one of the most influential psychological thinkers of the 18th century, published The English Malady, which includes the 40-page chapter The Case of the Author, dedicated to My Fellow Sufferers, in which he reports in minute detail on his neuroses, including fright, anxiety, dread, and terror, and a melancholy fright and panic, where my reason was of no use to me, and physical symptoms, including a sudden violent headache, extreme sickness in my stomach, and a constant colic and an ill taste and savor in my mouth over the years. More recently, the intellectual odysseys of Charles Darwin, Sigmund Freud, and William James were powerfully driven by their curiosity about and the desire to find relief from their own anxious suffering. Freud used his acute train phobia and his hypochondria, among other things, to construct his theory of psychoanalysis. Darwin was effectively housebound by stress-related illnesses after the voyage of the Beagle. He spent years in pursuit of relief from his anxiety, visiting spas and, on the advice of one doctor, encasing himself in ice. James tried to keep his phobias hidden from the public, but was often quietly terrified. I awoke morning after morning with a horrible dread in the pit of my stomach and with a sense of insecurity of life that I never knew before, he wrote in 1902 of the onset of his anxiety. For months, I was unable to go out in the dark alone. Unlike Darwin, Freud, and James, I'm not out to adumbrate a whole new theory of mind or of human nature. Rather, this book is motivated by a quest to understand and to find relief from or redemption in anxious suffering. This quest has taken me both backward into history and forward to the frontiers of modern scientific research. I have spent much of the past 8 years reading through hundreds of thousands of the pages that have been written about anxiety over the last 3,000 years. My life has, thankfully, lacked great tragedy or melodrama. I haven't served any jail time. I haven't been to rehab. I haven't assaulted anyone or carried out a suicide attempt. I haven't woken up naked in the middle of a field, sojourned in a crack house, or been fired from a job for erratic behavior. As psychopathologies go, mine has been, so far, most of the time, to outward appearances, quiet. Robert Downey Jr. will not be starring in the movie of my life. I am, as they say in the clinical literature, high-functioning for someone with an anxiety disorder or a mental illness. I'm usually quite good at hiding it. More than a few people, some of whom think they know me quite well, have remarked that they are struck that I, who can seem so even-keeled and imperturbable, would choose to write a book about anxiety. I smile gently while churning inside and thinking about what I've learned is a signature characteristic of the phobic personality. The need and ability, as described in the self-help book Your Phobia, to present a relatively placid, untroubled appearance to others while suffering extreme distress on the inside. For many, many people who have anxiety disorders, particularly agoraphobia and panic disorder, people would be surprised to find out that they have problems with anxiety because they seem so together and in control, says Paul Foxman, a psychologist who heads the Center for Anxiety Disorders in Burlington, Vermont. They seem to be comfortable, but there's a disconnection between the public self and the private self. To some people, I may seem calm, but if you could peer beneath the surface, you would see that I'm like a duck, paddling, paddling, paddling. The chief patient I am preoccupied with is myself. Sigmund Freud to Wilhelm Fliess, August 1897. It has occurred to me that writing this book might be a terrible idea. If it's relief from nervous suffering that I crave, then burrowing into the history and science of anxiety and into my own psyche is perhaps not the best way to achieve it. In my travels through the historical literature on anxiety, I came across a little self-help book by a British Army veteran named Wilfred Northfield, who suffered nervous prostration during the First World War and then spent 10 years largely incapacitated by anxiety before successfully convalescing and writing his Guide to Recovery. Published in 1933, Conquest of Nerves, the inspiring record of a personal triumph over neurasthenia, became a bestseller. The copy I have is from the 6th printing in 1934. In his last chapter, A Few Final Words, Northfield writes, "There is one thing the neurasthenic must guard against very strongly, and that is talking about his troubles. He can get no comfort or assistance in so doing." Northfield goes on, "To talk of troubles in a voluble, despairing way merely piles on the agony and plays up the emotions. Not only so, but it is selfish." Citing another author, he concludes, "Never display a wound, except to a physician." Never display a wound. Well, after more than 30 years of endeavoring, successfully much of the time, to conceal my anxiety from people, here I am putting it on protracted exhibition for acquaintances and strangers alike. If Northfield is correct, and my worried mother agrees with him, this project can hardly be auspicious for my mental health. Elements of modern research lend support to Northfield's warning. Anxious people have a pathological tendency to focus their attention inward, on themselves. In a way, that suggests a book-length dwelling on one's own anxiety is hardly the best way to escape it. David Barlow, one of the preeminent researchers in the field, notes, in the jargon-intensive terminology of the specialist, that pathological negative self-focus seems to be an integral part of the cognitive affective structure of anxiety. This negative self-evaluative focus and disruption of attention is in large part responsible for decreases in performance. This attention shift, in turn, contributes to a vicious cycle of anxious apprehension, in which increasing anxiety leads to further attentional shifts, increased performance deficits, and subsequent spiraling of arousal. Moreover, one concern I've had about writing this book is that I've subsisted professionally on my ability to project calmness and control. My anxiety makes me conscientious. I'm afraid of screwing things up. And my shame can make me seem poised. I need to hide that I'm anxious. A former colleague once described me as human Xanax, telling me, as I chuckled inwardly, that I project such equanimity that my mere presence can be calming to others. Simply to walk into a room full of agitated people is to administer my soothing balm. People relax in my wake. If only she knew. By revealing the fraudulence of my putative calm, am I forfeiting my ability to soothe others and thereby compromising my professional standing? My current therapist, Dr. W., says there is always the possibility that revealing my anxiety will lift the burden of shame and reduce the isolation of solitary suffering. When I get skittish about airing my psychiatric issues in a book, Dr. W. says, "You've been keeping your anxiety a secret for years, right? How's that working out for you?" Point taken. And there is a rich and convincing literature about how, contrary to the admonitions of Wilfred Northfield and my mother, hiding or suppressing anxiety actually produces more anxiety. On the desk in front of me is a 1997 article from the Journal of Abnormal Psychology called "Hiding Feelings: The Acute Effects of Inhibiting Negative and Positive Emotions." But there is no escaping my concern that this exercise is not only self-absorbed and shameful, but risky. That it will prove the Wile E. Coyote moment when I look down to discover that, Instead of inner strengths or outer buttresses to support me, there is in fact nothing to stop me from falling a long way down. I know how indecent and shocking egotism is, and for an author to make himself the subject of his words or works, especially in so tedious and circumstantiated a detail. But I thought perhaps it may not be quite useless to some low, desponding, valetudinary, overgrown person whose case may have some resemblance to mine. George Cheyne, The English Malady, 1733. Why, Dr. W. asks, do you think writing about your anxiety in a book would be so shameful? Because stigma still attaches to mental illness? Because anxiety is seen as weakness? Because, as the signs posted on Allied gun installations in Malta during World War II so bluntly put it, if you are a man, you will not permit your self-respect to admit an anxiety neurosis or to show fear. Because I worry that this book, with its revelations of anxiety and struggle, will be a litany of too much information, a violation of basic standards of restraint and decorum. As I write this, I can hear the strains of what may be my better judgment. Even if you are so unfortunate as to be excessively anxious, at least have the dignity not to prattle on about it publicly. Keep a stiff upper lip and keep it to yourself. When I explain this to Dr. W., he says that the very act of working on this book and of publishing it could be therapeutic. In presenting my anxiety to the world, he says, I will be coming out. The implication is that this will be liberating, as though I were gay and coming out of the closet. But being gay, we now finally know, homosexuality was classified as a mental disorder by the American Psychiatric Association until 1973, is not a weakness or a defect or an illness. Being excessively nervous is. For a long time, governed by reticence and shame, I had told people who inquired about my book that it was a cultural and intellectual history.